Good morning. My name is Rebecca Kosery. I am the chair of the Department of History and director of the African American Studies. And I'm very pleased to see so many of you here this morning for our first speaker and presentation of the Crowe Symposium for Thursday. Our first presenter is Dr. Doris Marie Provine. She is a professor of justice studies at Arizona State University. She has both a law degree and a PhD in political science from Cornell University and is interested in problems of justice and law from a socio-legal perspective. Her most recent book is entitled Unequal Under the Law, Race and the War on Drugs. Here it is, which was published in 2007. Dr. Provine's current research focuses on local policies toward unauthorized immigrants and their links to national, meta-national, and international developments. With support from the Fulbright Foundation, she has investigated differences in how neighboring nations engage local governments in the enforcement of immigration laws. She is currently principal investigator of a NSF-funded study of responses of sheriffs and police departments to the federal invitation to undertake immigration enforcement. Dr. Provine is very active in the area of immigration, having worked with a Somali refugee family for the past 4 years, and participates regularly in naturalization workshops. She occasionally participates in marching for immigrant and women's rights, anti-war causes, and is active in voter education and registration. Dr. Provine is also active in many outdoor activities, ranging from gardening to competitive rowing, and loves to spend time hiking and cycling. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Provine.
Thank you very much. I want to start by saying thank you for coming at this hour out in the fog to come to the symposium this morning, and thanks very much to the Crowe Committee for setting things up, and what a thrill to have a musical interlude to start all this with. Well, as Rebecca said, I have a big interest in immigration now, but I certainly haven't lost my interest in the war on drugs or the problem of over-imprisonment and mass incarceration in our society. In fact, just the other day, I was working with the ACLU on what to do about our latest bozo proposal in Arizona to build yet 500 more maximum security beds in our state prisons, privately run by corporations, and 500 more ordinary beds while we have a declining crime rate. So this issue just never goes away, especially in Arizona, number 5 in imprisonment in the United States, despite being a small state. So here we are with race and the war on drugs. And I hope, how many of you were at the talk last night by Michelle Alexander? Just a show of hands. That's great. What a terrific and important speech that was. I'm so glad so many of us got to watch that and hear that. What I'm going to do today is to kind of extend and not exactly complicate, but specify a little bit more some of the issues that she raised in doing that massive and wonderful overview last night. So I'm going to see if my clicker works here. Perfect. Okay, now one way to kind of help us think this through is to think about myths about the criminal justice process that a lot of people hold. Maybe not this audience, because you're more sophisticated. You're college students, you're college professors, and you came last night. You got a great introduction to the problems from a really serious, critical point of view. But you'll find a lot of people who believe in all of or most of the myths that are here. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to go over these myths one by one, these 4 myths, and we'll see where that takes us. Okay, so myth number 1, that illicit drug use has kind of become one of those problems to which we must respond. And in this country, unfortunately, when we think we must do something, generally we declare a war on it, and a lot of wars have a lot of casualties, and certainly this one does, and our favorite solution more and more tends to be, let's use criminal sanctions and imprisonment. And certainly the idea that drugs are dangerous and ruining our communities has provoked that response. And it's very interesting to see, as you do in the next slide here, that actually it doesn't really fit that paradigm of the sudden appearance of a really dangerous problem. It's not like 9/11, for example. We have records of drug use. Believe it or not, they really think they know that the Neanderthals got high. And, you know, think about how they lived. I mean, you would probably want to get high, too, given what it was like. But they have the, you know, the little seeds in the caves that suggest, yes, they, too, were drug users. And the most amazing thing, and one of the things that I discuss in my book, which takes some of the same issues but from a little different perspective than Michelle did last night, is just this history of periodic reaction to drug use. And when you go back to the 19th century and you see those, you know, the British, who, you know, we think of as so reserved and under control, fighting to make Chinese use more opium, it kind of gets you, doesn't it? And then we think about Prohibition, our own kind of drug craze of the early 20th century, and that's another time that we can begin to think, oh, you know, we do have a kind of a weird way of reacting to mind-altering substances. And what I find is the most interesting period in our history is the period that lasted a long time when all sorts of addictive substances were out there at like the CVS or the Walgreens. You could just go if you had a toothache and you got something that actually it just made you want to keep taking it like forever because it was a narcotic, you know, and people were addicted to these remedies because they were unregulated, and hey, narcotics work pretty well when you have a toothache. So the idea of drug abuse for a long time in this country was associated with people who, you know, really nice people, people who might live around here, who, you know, just went to the store and got something and then got addicted to it, kind of like the OxyContin painkiller issue is for some people. And so it was treated as one of those things that doctors were the experts in and that we should all feel very empathetic and sympathetic to people who got kind of stuck in this situation. And that changed, obviously. We live today. How did it change? It changed because certain, what we might call moral entrepreneurs, made it change. They worked very hard to recast drugs as dangerous substances. And, of course, we did start having drug regulations, so all those people with toothaches didn't continue to be addicted inadvertently, or maybe just continue it because it felt so good. So that attitude changed profoundly, and race had everything to do with it. Chris Rock, I thought, said it very succinctly. When it seemed like a white problem, it seemed like a health problem, but it was reconstructed. And I don't know, I think this is such a beautiful big screen, you can probably read this. I go into some detail in this in my book because it's a really interesting history, how with rather concerted effort of a few leaders of our country, the whole issue of drugs got recast as something that those dangerous people, those racial others, those foreigners who sneaked across the border from Mexico, those blacks who never knew what they were going to do, and when they used drugs, you really didn't know what they were going to do. This recasting took a bit of time, but it was kind of like what Michelle Alexander talked last night about the Reagan drug war, that, you know, you plant the idea that drugs are dangerous, partly because they are being used by people that we want to keep under better control, and if they're using drugs, they're going to forget all those social controls. So race and drugs, when it becomes one of these social crisis issues, is completely tied up with race. Race is kind of like the fire that makes the issue burn in people's consciousness. And these are just historically, these are not sort of like something I made up. You can look at the New York Times from the period when in the 20s, 30s, 40s, when the issues were treated this way by respectable publications, Good Housekeeping, that kind of thing. Okay, the result, and obviously we are going to talk about sort of how we got to this result in more detail. This reviews some of what was mentioned last night of this incredible growth in imprisonment and how to the huge extent it has been driven by the drug war. We've had kind of two things going at once, a kind of a general more incarceration mentality, a kind of nothing else works, so we'll have to put them away, or the penal sanctions will really get their attention, that kind of mood which has affected crime issues in general, and a kind of a lock them up and throw away the key, they're hopeless mentality going. At the same time, the war on drugs has been driving the numbers. And as Michelle said last night, it's so institutionalized that it's a really formidable thing to figure out, oh, how do we get out of this situation? Well, when we talk about something like the new Jim Crow or just how we got there, one of the key questions, we have to ask two key questions that are easy not to think about. One is, it's not just how we treat people under the drug laws as they are. We need to think about how do we get the drug laws that we have? And how did we get them and how do we get out of them? What have our state legislatures and Congress tried to do? What did they do this on purpose? And if they did it on purpose, you know, if it's like get the underclass or get black people and Latinos, then that's one set of solutions. And if it's kind of a constellation of negligence, political ambition, and excitement, well, to put it in its most positive form, then that suggests other solutions. So I think we need to ask that. And then I did a little math for you. As you can probably have vaguely surmised, I'm fairly old, you know? I'm like ancient by the standards of most people in this room. And one, there are not too many advantages to being old, but one of them is you've actually seen some things change. And in my lifetime, I have seen change from the time when I was a pretty little girl and would visit places where segregation legally was still practiced. I've seen that change. I've seen white-only drinking fountains myself. I've seen white-only restrooms and black-only restrooms. So I've seen some change. And I started thinking, well, I remember growing up just what segregation was like and how it slowly changed to the world we have today, where those kinds of segregation are no longer practiced, certainly by law. We still have housing segregation and, as a result, educational segregation. I'm not saying it went away, but that sort of sense of, wow, this must be pretty serious because the law says we have to be separate, that period is over. But hey, let's think about those members of Congress that passed the drug laws. Now, as you know, the big drug laws at the federal level, the states kind of followed along on this, but let's just take the leading edge here, the federal level. They were passed in 1986 and 1988. So I thought, well, you know what? I bet those legislators, I bet those members of Congress, they were even older than I am now, or close to that, when they passed this law. So I looked at the average age of members of the House and members of the Senate when the drug laws were passed. And this is kind of shorthand here, but you can see where it says HR, House of Representatives, the average age was 50-51, okay? In the Senate, a little bit older, 55-56. Okay, well, let's look at how old they were when the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed. Well, they were pretty well grown up. They, in the House, they were 20, it should be 20, 21, not 20 to 30. It's actually just Democrats tend to be a little bit older than Republicans, I guess, you know. We're just a little wiser over time or something. Who knows? Anyway, so here they are, same people. They were in their 20s when we finally got to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. When Brown versus Board of Ed was decided, Brown versus Board of Education, which was an extremely important decision, not for its immediate effects, which didn't occur right away, but for the symbolic statement that segregation is no longer the law of the land. How old were they then? Well, they were old enough to be at least somewhat aware of that. So the Congress that passed the war on drugs, that got this really going in the 80s, which is, these are still laws that we're dealing with, they were people who were very much part of a racially segregated America. That's the America they knew growing up. And, you know, while you can say, well, that doesn't mean they were trying to continue it in the war on drugs, it does mean they were sensitized to race in a way that you, as young people today, would find, I think, pretty repugnant. And so we need to think, that was a mentality that governed the drug laws that we have today, that mentality from those days back then. Okay, now, Michelle mentioned just very briefly last night, but it's also an important piece of this sort of psychological story of how we got these drug laws, and this issue of implicit racism, of unconscious racism. And I just am briefly noting here some of the findings that are very strong in the psychology literature that have been tested with lots and lots of psychology classes being given, lots and lots of tests, and lots of replication of results. And those experiments and that research suggests that we learn everything we know as little people. When you guys were little and I was little, we were struggling with certain concepts like, what's a chair? What's a table? What's a daddy? What's a school? And we make generalizations. And the way we've kind of progressed is we generalize across our experiences to create a concept. This has some unfortunate characteristics in the area of race, because we're not really aware of how we do this. We do it kind of in the back part of our brain, and then we use it. And there are certain kinds of characteristic mistakes that people make in making these generalizations. And one of them is the false attribution error. And I like this one because I do it all the time myself. I recognized it immediately. It's like, you know, when you're having a bad day and, you know, you're grouchy with your friends or something, and you say to yourself, well, you know, I just didn't get enough sleep last night. I didn't feel good. And you know, I'm not like this. I just haven't, you know, I'm not a good day for me. I heard some bad news or something. Well, when somebody that we don't know is grouchy with us, let's say you get on the bus and the bus driver snarls at you, you think, that guy's a jerk, to put it in the kindest terms. You know, what kind of creepy guy would be driving the bus? You know, you don't think, oh, he's just having a bad day. You assume that's who he is. So that's the false attribution error. The outgroup error is to assume always, and we do this unconsciously. This is what's so amazing about it. These are things that are just in there that we don't necessarily know about unless we take psychology classes, is the outgroup error, that we assume we kind of assume better of our group than them. And we see the same behavior. We're more ready to find excuses for it if it's people like us than people who aren't like us. And then there's the confirmation error, that we tend to sort of filter the information that comes in. So we have disconfirming evidence. Obama's elected president. Well, yeah, but he's really outstanding. I mean, he's just unusual, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And from a racial perspective, this is very unfortunate, because we have examples of exactly what the generalization we might be living with would disconfirm if we would only believe that that was disconfirming evidence. But our tendency is to suppress that and go on and keep our generalization, because generalizations help us keep the world a little more organized. So in a sense, we're fighting, if we want to fight racial prejudice, we actually have to make it a conscious project That this is something we're going to fight against in our own unconscious tendencies that we just have to look at consciously to kind of beat back. Kind of like when you go on a diet and you beat back that desire for another piece of cake. You know you have to do it even though it feels like you need that cake no matter what. So we can't unlearn these things without being pretty darn conscious about it. Okay, now let's go into that second generalization that, come on, the criminal justice system's got a lot of protections. I'm a lawyer, I can tell you, they're there. So why don't they work and sort of prevent the problem of kind of sucking in too many people of color in the criminal justice network? That was a major topic last night, and it's a major observation you can make about our prison system. So why not all of these protections work? Well, the answer is we have two aspects of the criminal justice system. We have the kind of on-paper version that is, it's pretty good as far as due process protections. We have a right to a lawyer, et cetera. All these things were fairly hard won. Some of them were, and some of them are constitutional requirements. But we also have an enforcement, as in so many things, like, let's say, college teaching, a lot of discretion. In fact, it's a huge amount of discretion getting bigger all the time in the criminal justice system. And I just made a kind of a, because I know I'm not going to have as much time as it would take to really lay these out, I just made a list here for you so you can think about the places where that unconscious racism, or maybe conscious racism, could actually have an impact. And if you think about it as a criminal justice process, I think it really helps you kind of conceptualize it. So, you start with a decision of where are you going to concentrate your law enforcement resources? What neighborhoods? On this campus or in a part of town where people are less likely to call their parents and say, there are cops all over the place. Well, okay, probably not on this campus or not in the very nice parts of town. So there's those deployment decisions, totally discretionary. Nobody says you have to do it in a certain way. And we don't because we want law enforcement to make good decisions about where to go. So we have discretion for a reason. Okay, seeing drug deals. Now this is an amazing thing, and it goes back to this psychology thing. There's been a terrific study by people in the University of Washington who managed to persuade the Seattle police to ride along with them on their patrols. And they did it for thousands of hours. And what they found, much to their surprise, they noticed this deployment thing that the police would almost automatically go to mixed race and minority neighborhoods rather than white neighborhoods. That was one finding, and that wasn't surprising. But what was surprising was when they watched the police making drug busts, these ride-along graduate students mostly, they would see drug deals going on among whites, but the police wouldn't see them. This happened over and over. It was as if the police were kind of programmed to think drug deal, minority person. And if those two things didn't go together, they didn't really pick up those clues. And so even on the scene, the arrests tend to be in terms of minorities as opposed to non-minorities. There's, of course, the decision of whether to arrest for a minor drug deal or for something else where you might discover drugs on someone. And probably more than a few people in this room have had the experience of talking themselves out of an arrest. This can be done. And it is done, and we all would like to do that in situations where we know we did something that was really minor and we don't want to end up with dealing with the police any longer. So whether to arrest or not, that's discretionary as well, and for good reason, because we want the police to use judgment. Judgment is discretion. So I'm really talking about a system that it's not corrupt because it has discretion. It has to have discretion, but what it has to have is more consciousness about these unconscious biases, and it has to take the racists out of the police force. And I'm not suggesting there are a lot of them, but certainly in Arizona, in the immigration arena that I work in now, I know there are people who look at people differently depending on race. Okay, the discretion story goes on and on. The prosecutors have to make charging decisions. That means they have to decide what crime to charge you with. Now, given how many of our drug laws are what we call mandatory minimums that require if you're charged with X, your penalty is Y, that charging decision is terribly important. And so prosecutorial discretion is something that is very important, and as Michelle said last night, virtually unreviewable. I could explain more about that in the Q&A if people want. And so they're plea deals. Some get better ones, some get worse ones. The quality of the prosecution and the defense is going to involve a lot of discretion on how to make the case or whether to try to make the case. And we hear about all sorts of cases in the criminal justice system on murder cases where these cases get reviewed over again and the defense decided not to fight or just decided their client was guilty, let's just get on with it. Sentencing recommendations, another area of enormous discretion. And then there's the whole question of what we do with people once they're in prison, and that there are a lot of decisions about what kind of programs to offer, and some of those are made by voters as well as administrators. And so you see this enforcement bias. This is a good slide for showing you how the kind of penalty of discretion keeps getting stronger as you go through the process, because if you look at drug dealing, you don't find racial differences. They start appearing in the criminal justice system, and they get more pronounced as that system works through the process. Now, you might say, well, now, Provine, you're not really noting that there could be racial differences in the seriousness of drug violations. It might be that, you know, whites are less guilty or do less serious things. But in fact, as was mentioned last night, and I just want to reiterate this point, most drug arrests are for very minor drug infractions. That's why we can make the argument that people need to be treated much differently, because you're not talking about career criminals here. You're talking about young people, usually young people, who are kind of bereft of a lot of the kind of opportunities that this audience has and that I've had, and that they end up in drug dealing as a kind of a final resort in making their way out of home and making some kind of living for themselves. And so you're looking at a system that's capturing not the drug kingpins, but the kind of volunteer bottom of the drug pyramid. Okay, well, let's go on. Generalization number three, if discrimination exists, courts will eliminate it. This is how I got into this issue personally. I'll just take a second to say that. I started noticing when I started researching this area that there were judges who were actually quitting their highly paid, prestigious jobs because of the war on drugs. I noticed that there were judges who were so dissatisfied that they would weep. One of them was my boss when I was working in Washington for a year, a really hard-nosed guy who I didn't think even had a heart. And there he was. You know, I read a newspaper article about him crying at a sentencing in a drug case. It blew me away. And so there was something there. And what is there, as I thought was well explained last night, is that the Supreme Court has basically closed the courthouse door to charges of discrimination in the entire criminal justice system, from arrest to prosecutorial decisions to sentencing decisions. It's really amazing. And again, this is something I can talk about with you in the Q&A, but it's shocking, really, to look at these cases that say things like, yeah, you can't even have the information the prosecutor had in order to see if there is racial discrimination. But I thought it might be useful to give you a little break from me and hear this from a judge himself. And so can you play that? It's a, like a little one of those YouTube videos. And this is a trial court judge who I hope will come up on the screen here in a second, who will explain to you in a minute and a half.
Conservative family what's in La Cañada, which is close to Pasadena in the Rose Bowl. My father was a federal judge, highly regarded. I was in the Peace Corps in Costa Rica, then I went back for 3 years of law school at USC, and then was a Navy JAG attorney for 4 years. Then I was appointed to the bench. I had the guidance of my father. I'd been a trial attorney for quite a while, and I just, that really felt like the right thing. It became immediately apparent to me when I was a judge, watching what was going on in my own courtroom, that we were churning low-level drug offenders through the system for no good purpose. There are mandatory minimum sentences, and there have been times in which I've known of judges, federal, state, are literally in tears because they know that this sentence is inappropriate. And so they would apologize to people, but as they're sending them to prison for 10 years, they know full well it really shouldn't even be a prison sentence, or maybe 1 or 2 years, but they have to follow the law. We, in the United States of America, contrary to virtually every country that I'm aware of, have focused on jails, focused on prisons. We lead the world in the incarceration of our people, both by sheer numbers as well as per capita. It's extremely expensive, both in financial terms as well as human terms. We have to get smart on crime instead of tough on crime. Probation, mental health facilities, strict accountability, quicker justice. Let's make drug treatment more available for people, and we won't need all of these prisons. We simply can't afford it, and it doesn't work.
There you go. I thought he put it pretty succinctly, and he's a judge, and he's not a bleeding heart liberal. He's a conservative who sees this as the failed war that it is. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go quickly here. McCleskey versus Kemp is the key case that closed that door, and we'll talk about that. I want to get to that fourth myth quickly, and that is, well, if our leaders, you know, when they understand this, when they get the good information, it's a democratic system, you know, we will do better with this. But you just have to remember how old this drug war is. And so we're talking like 28th anniversary of the first federal law, and the state laws were very short to follow. McCleskey not far behind. And, you know, the story is out there. It's not like, you know, Michelle Alexander or Marie Provine are going to, like, tell the world something they haven't heard. We know a lot of these facts, of this incredible cost, if their Congress is doing anything, which, of course, is a bit of an open question. They should know that they're spending a lot of money on this. $1 trillion is, you know, it's not pocket change. And they also should know about some of the consequences, which I've listed here for you, about drug deaths going up, drug availability staying the same, and people getting less and less availability to treatment when they are in prison, which is about the most perverse thing possible. And we have this high recidivism rate because we make it so hard to be reintegrated in the system, and you heard a lot about that last night. There have been remedial steps. You'll hear people say, well, yeah, but we're addressing the problem. And there have been a few steps, but they are tiny. Let me tell you, they are tiny. A little more discretion for judges, a little more willingness to look at disparities, and a few states on really economic grounds saying, we just can't keep doing this. Not Arizona, but other states like Mississippi have it a little better figured out. Bottom line here is that the basic picture is unchanged. And one of the reasons it's unchanged is because now marijuana has become the big drug bust topic. And, you know, there are probably people in this room who know at least a little bit about marijuana, and you can say, marijuana is not heroin. It's not the same. Not the same. Definitely not the same. So what we have is an institution that's rolling along, and it almost it isn't very conscious of its metrics, to use the term. So I want to just get quickly and close here and open this up for questions. What to do? Okay, I thought here's where we could take it a little further and kind of get a little more specific about that social movement that we need to have. I don't think litigation is the answer. That's a hard thing for a lawyer to say. but given what the Supreme Court has done, I think it's the correct answer. And I think we need to think that democracy isn't necessarily the answer, because democracy without some big pressure isn't the answer, because we've got a population here that is vulnerable because it's not powerful. And I think Dr. Menjivar, when she talks about immigration, will make somewhat the same observation, that a system that responds to political pressure is sometimes going to turn on those who can't make political pressure, who can't push our legislators into thinking about their needs. And this is that population that we're talking about. We need to have a lot of other people stand up for this vulnerable population. Okay, do we need a new civil rights movement? Absolutely. The outrage of what is happening in our country with 50 million people with criminal convictions or under criminal supervision, that's in a country of 300 million. This is nuts. And it's a civil rights outrage. It's not just a black-white issue. It's a civil rights issue for all of us. It isn't as if this net only catches minorities. It's just use minorities as the engine to grow into its ugly, ugly self. But here's where I want to really talk with you, and that is, given the weight of the institutional weight and the sort of devotion to this colorblind racism, which is really an idea that we can't talk about race, we'll just make it worse. Given that, and given how much fear we have of crime, how do we do this social movement? How can you just launch it, or do you have to sort of chew at this and bite off pieces? And, you know, I'm not sure I know the answer, but I thought I would just throw out the kind of arguments that would draw a constituency that isn't just the folks like many of you in this room who are devoted enough to social justice that, hey, you know, you're willing to give a lot of time to this as a matter of social justice. What about the practicality crowd? Well, there are a lot of practical arguments for doing something about the war on drugs. How much should we emphasize those? Now, Michelle worries that we'll nickel and dime it and therefore not invest in communities that are devastated by this war and by poverty in general. It's a great point. But the real question is sort of, where do you start? And I just want to throw one final idea over here of what kinds of, where do we start? I think we start with political pressure. I think we start by requiring decency in the conversation. You wouldn't believe, when the drug laws were passed, drug dealers were referred to as vermin and rats. That should not be possible in our political discussion. We should starve that criminal justice beast, at least the parts of it that we know are doing bad things, like those grants that give local areas every incentive to do more and more arrests. We should end the war on marijuana to start with, for goodness sakes, because a lot of people know that's not such a big deal. My gosh, Nixon was just about ready to invite the people, the pro-marijuana people, into the White House for a chat. So our history includes some tolerance for marijuana. We need to think a lot about the public health approach that other countries are adopting. And I love the idea that came up last night, and this is particularly relevant to this audience, of creating an underground railroad of acceptance of people with drug and other felony convictions that are disabled for life. It's time for us to start making life more bearable for those folks. It's just wrong to see this happening, and that's the kind of thing we can do at a pretty local, individual, social level. Thank you very much for your attention. And I really look forward to your questions and comments.
Would you recommend that members of the criminal justice system, like police officers and judges, take an implicit association test to see what racism they have that they don't recognize?
Would I recommend that they take a what?
Implicit association test.
Yes, I think that would be a good idea. It'd have to be carefully done, because, you know, police officers tend to be a little bit on the defensive about their work. You know, I work with police officers in my immigration work, and, you know, the fact is they're somewhat isolated from a lot of the rest of society. They know each other and they work together, but there's an isolation problem. So you'd have to say, hey, look, we're not saying you're special. We're just saying you're more powerful than many other sectors of society in this problem, and so we really need to work on this because it's a problem we all have that we all need to work on, and we're just going to help you pinpoint it a bit more. So it'd have to be couch drive, but I totally think that would be a fabulous idea.
Hi, thank you for talking to us, Ms. Provine. You, like Ms. Alexander, spent a lot of time telling us about these minorities. And also, like Ms. Alexander, when you come to the end, you tell us it's not really about the minorities, it's about civil rights for all felons. So why would we not erase this language, erase this binary system from this movement, and focus on the rights for the felons instead of the whites versus non-whites?
Well, that's a really interesting point from a political perspective. I have to, as a social scientist, see it from a historical perspective, and I really do see that the race issue is what has driven us into the kind of what you might call overdrive of drug prohibition. And I think for some people, the civil rights implications of having such racial disproportion in prisons is a big issue, and it should be, for all of us, a big issue. But you're also right, I think, to say politically, and really just in terms of the facts, we've gotten into over-incarceration, not just in drugs, but in other areas, and whites as well as non-whites are affected by drug laws. Although with that vacuum cleaner working particularly in minority neighborhoods, that's part of the problem that needs to be de-raced. So it's really a both and I think one approach, especially with audiences that want to think about justice in a more general way and kind of making government do what people want it to do, should be thinking about over-incarceration. That is really, we've overindulged in a big way. It's like type 2 diabetes of incarceration. So I definitely think that should be a big part of the discussion, and in some places maybe that's where the discussion starts. For me, it doesn't because of the history, but great point. Yes.
I live in San Antonio, and I'm just learning how to do advocacy on an individual basis through visiting inmates, and I'm learning that the right to a speedy trial just isn't there. And I'm wondering, what would you suggest for those of us who want to act as go-betweens with individual inmates, how to get legal representation in a timely way and an effective way?
Yeah, the problem is that the way the plea deals are organized is that if you exercise your right for trial, you can be hit with a much, much longer punishment. So it becomes one of those sort of, you know, like rolling the dice situations. You don't know the jury you're going to get. And as Michelle mentions in her book, and I do in mine too, I think, there's the problem of peremptory challenges of a jury. So you might get a jury that knows kind of nothing about these issues and is knee-jerk upset about whatever the crime is, a drug crime, and you might get convicted and then be locked away forever. So I think in advocacy, you know, people need to be, and I think they are aware of the stakes. But one of the issues for you, I'm sure, is helping to rebuild self-respect and think about how to use the time away from social interaction in a normal way in prison to prepare oneself for reentering and fighting those little things within the system itself that these people are suffering from, like high-priced telephone calls that are like $8 for 2 minutes to talk to your kids. Those things are things that can be changed without federal legislation. They're things that can be changed by advocates like you. So good luck with your work. It's really important.
Thank you.
All right. My name is Zach. I've been learning, and many people who are in favor of the drug war, they would often address kids in public schools, so they would be against drugs as well. Now, in order to fix a problem like this, should we also address kids in public schools so they would also be aware?
Yeah, but you know what we do? We have, you know, the Just Say No program and the DARE program, And we don't really admit that we're really doing drug law enforcement in a very differentiated way. And I think kids sort of know that, and they kind of wonder if this is, you know, in my group, there's no problem, we can experiment with drugs. I'm a little sad, frankly, that our country is so hyped up on this, that a little experimentation with drugs, not that it's a good thing, but it's not the worst thing. And if it's a total abstinence, you're really bad if you try anything approach. It doesn't work so well with kids, but we sort of don't have any other choice about what that message should be. So I don't know exactly how we reformulate the message. We don't say, you know, you might want to, if you really want to experiment a little, just be safe. We can't do that. And on the other hand, if you just say no, don't try anything in one try, and poof, you're going to go down the tubes, that's not going to be very believable. And so we're kind of in a bad spot. I think the minimum we ought to do is say, you know, drugs are dangerous, and we've had some problems in this country with how to formulate a policy that actually protects communities, all communities, without violating people's rights. Let's think about that, too.
Thank you.
Other questions? Anyone? Well, I really appreciate you being here. I appreciate your attention. I appreciate your questions. This has been a real thrill, and I just wish I could meet this Crost person that made this whole symposium possible. So thanks again.